Today's program is brought to you by Tabard Inn, new American cuisine in one of Washington, D.C.'s oldest hotels, located in DuPont Circle. For more information, visit tabardinn.com.
Today's program has been brought to you by Route 11 Potato Chips. Made with a secret recipe and superior ingredients, their mission is to make an outstanding product in a safe and clean environment. For more information, visit www.rt11.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hello, hello. Welcome to episode one of the third season, the winter season of Recommended Reading with Food Book Fair. I'm one of your co-hosts, Kimberly Chow, one of the co-directors of Food Book Fair, an annual festival about reading and writing about eating, which is now going to be biannual as we're launching in Los Angeles, in case you missed the news, March 2nd through March 4th, at the Ace Hotel downtown Los Angeles. More on that soon. It's just me today. Amanda Dell, my co-director and co-host, is out of the booth, but we are very, very happy to be joined in studio with Hedy McKinnon, who is the author of many wonderful cookbooks in Australia and here, Community, Neighborhood among them, and also the publisher and founder of a beautiful new journal about exploring the multiculturalism of food called Peddler. Hey, Hedy.
Hey, Kim. Thanks for having me.
Happy to have you here. Usually, Amanda and I start off by talking about what we've each been reading, watching, or listening to. And you and I hung out about a week ago over coffee and already geeked out about some books and what we've been watching. So would love to hear what you've been catching up on, what's been on your nightstand, if you've finished anything, what I've been doing.
Takes me a while to finish something.
That's okay. I have multiple books going at one time usually.
Yeah, absolutely. Me too.
So what have you been reading?
So I have been reading this book called Mama, which is by Mina Holland, who's the editor of one of the supplements in The Guardian in the UK. And it's actually a book I've had for quite some time. I bought it last year sometime and I actually put it aside. I didn't want to read it because I was working on my third book, which is a kind of similar material. So when I'm working on something like that, I actually don't want to do too much research into similar topics. But I've just recently, that book is in editing phase, so I've just picked it up in the last couple of weeks. And it's all about kind of looking at food as our identity and the influence of the food that your mothers and or grandmothers cook and how that influences you through the rest of your life. It's like your edible living history, which is kind of a topic that's really kind of on trend with me at the moment. Super interesting.
Cool. Are there any particular points or through lines in the book or resonances with you?
Well, I love the... I'll just pick it up here. I love how they talk about kind of how food is almost like character. So we look at some dishes from our childhood and they might not be the most thrilling dishes or the most like it's not gourmet food, it's not what you get at a restaurant, but for some reason, you know, bland food is almost... I love that she talks about blandness, like the food that she eats is actually quite bland. And it's how that those foods can be incredibly comforting. So, and I can think of lots of bland food. I think we both spoke about this last week.
Do you want to tell our listeners one of the signature Chinese diasporic bland foods universally beloved?
Totally. It's this tomato and egg dish, which my fellow partner in crime in Peddler, Shirley Kai, wrote an article about in the first issue. So it's about this dish that is really strange in many ways because tomatoes don't feature in Chinese cooking all that much, mm-hmm. And definitely not in Cantonese cooking, which is my cultural heritage. But I grew up eating this dish. It was really saucy and kind of not that tasty because I don't think my mother used organic tomatoes or it was just whatever beef, big tomatoes she had lying around. And it was just, you know, a little bit sweet, not that much taste, and then with egg through it.
For listeners that aren't familiar, can you describe that a little bit more? Like, is it saucy? Like, because obviously in other food cultures there are eggs and tomato sauce, mm-hmm. but this is not exactly that.
It's not really different. I mean, the recipe that's in the first issue of Peddler is actually tomatoes that have been cooked down with a bit of rock sugar, mm-hmm. and then scrambled egg, mm-hmm. and then this kind of slightly watery egg that's kind of mixed through it.
Okay.
My mum's version was actually really different.
What was your mum's version?
It was like almost like a tomato stew. So okay. really, really liquidy. But she would drop the egg in. So okay. it was like an egg drop tomato soup / stew.
Tomato forward, though.
Very much.
So I was just in Detroit. Mm-hmm. Doing some organizing with my partners in crime in the Allied Media Conference, which is an incredible radical media-based organizing conference based in Detroit where people use technology, zine making, mm-hmm. Art, culture, DJing to create the world that we wish to live in that's more creative and just. And I spent some time in the suburbs of mm-hmm. Detroit with my parents. And the first day I got home actually and stayed with them, my mom said, "Do you want something to eat? There is tomato and egg in the refrigerator."
Oh,
I never,
really?
I did not actually eat it on this trip, but I saw it in its,
she had it pre-made.
Yeah. It was like she had made it earlier that week.
Oh, wow. Oh,
and
wow.
So I saw it in its, Tupperware container. It was like a hard scramble. Uh-huh. It was mostly, it was more egg forward.
Yes.
Less tomato.
Oh, really?
But it was like a watery tomato.
Yeah. Every family has its own version of this dish.
For those of you who are listening who have not eaten this before, it's actually really delicious in a bland, lovingly bland way. I think I've only ever had it very lightly seasoned.
Yeah. I mean, it's not even, when I started talking to people about this dish, I got such enthusiastic responses. Mm. Like, you know, when you text someone and someone sends you 20 texts in 3 seconds, it was kind of like that. People are so enthusiastic about this dish and it suddenly kind of made me think of it in a different way. Like, why does this dish comfort when it's really not that exciting? Mm. I mean, for me, I still remember this dish, even though my mum didn't make it a lot, mm-hmm. but it still ranks very high up there in my own edible food history.
So if you haven't seen the magazine yet and you'd like to pick up a copy of Peddler wherever fine magazines are sold, many places where fine magazines are sold, including Now Serving, our favorite culinary and cookbook store in Los Angeles and one of our partners for Food Book Fair LA, there's a recipe and you can make your own based on Shirley Kai's recipe.
It was actually about it was Zeki Chan's recipe.
Okay.
So it was her story about leaving home and this dish being the one that she wanted to replicate to feel like she was with her mother or closer to her mother who lives in Hong Kong.
So okay.
She lives in New York. So.
Okay. Is that one egg forward, tomato forward, or sort of in between?
I think it's an in-between one.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm hoping this sort of plants seeds for a lot of people that want to do further research and investigation into tomato and egg. But, you know, shout out to the Chinese folks out there that know what we're talking about.
Totally. We want to hear their versions because I think everyone has their own version.
And also just to say that the first issue of Peddler is about Chinatowns around the world, which is incredibly inspiring. And personally for me as a person with a connection to Chinese culture and my background and my ancestry, I always love seeing how Chinatowns operate, how people mm-hmm. live, what people eat around the world, wherever I travel in different cities that have Chinese populations. So that was really exciting
yeah.
for me. And then can you talk about what your second issue will be? Because that's sort of like a nice connection and it thematic is. Continuity, speaking of the Mina Holland Mama.
Yeah, so book. The next issue is themed childhood.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of, it's a little bit fun, but it's not kind of twee in any way. It's really looking at, it's very nostalgic. So it looks at the foods that made us happy mm-hmm. when we were young. But also like memory, like I've written an article in there that is kind of the first time I've mentioned my dad who passed away when I was young. Mm-hmm. So it was, I kind of wrote that with kind of crying, but it was really cathartic mm-hmm. in a way. And there was always food in our family. My dad worked at the markets and mm-hmm. he was a banana salesman.
Mm-hmm.
So I've kind of written that story with a couple of banana desserts, but ironically my dad never ate anything sweet because he had diabetes mm-hmm. so it's kind of ironic in a way because the recipes I've attached to him are sweet
yeah
because he was kind of the banana man mm-hmm. so yeah. And there's another story in there that it's about my friend Oripen, who is a Singaporean Chinese mm-hmm. and she grew up in Singapore during the 80s
mm-hmm.
and the story just came about because I told her about the theme of the issue and she just looked at me and said, well, actually, everything I know about food is from my housekeeper.
Mm.
And that line just, I couldn't let mm-hmm. it go. And we sat down for a chat and it's a really riveting story about how sometimes, you know, because you read a lot about how you are influenced, your food choices are from your parents or mm-hmm. your grandparents. But what about when it's someone completely... You know, this person was the person that nurtured her, that mm-hmm. nourished her, that
raised her,
but she's not yeah. blood related. And I was really kind of, it was really an emotional, she's read the story, she was very emotional when she read mm-hmm. it, so it brought back a lot of memories for her.
Mm-hmm.
So there's kind of a few fun things in there too. There's a whole section about celebrations.
Mm-hmm.
And the way I write a lot of the articles, I have a few more contributors in the second issue. But I wanted to write a recipe for not shark fin soup. So shark fin soup without the shark fin. But when I sat down to write the recipe, I actually wrote an entire article about wedding banquets
mm-hmm.
just by accident because I kind of associate shark fin soup
yeah.
With, you know, those kind of big banquet celebrations.
What is the mock shark fin in the recipe?
I use a sweet potato noodle, you know, oh, that kind
yeah,
of...
Yeah, yeah.
It's because you just kind of want that kind of gelatinous... I mean, it's actually a soup that my mum made all the time, like whenever it was our birthday. But I think in later years, by the time we were teenagers, I think everyone had dropped the actual shark fin.
Uh-huh.
I had no idea what I was eating, by the way, so yeah. had I
that
known...
That happened to me a lot when I was a kid.
Being a vegetarian, it's quite shocking to me now, but yeah.
How long have you been a vegetarian?
Really long time, like 20 something years.
Wow.
Yeah, since I was a teenager. That's giving away my age, but which was very I think my family still don't accept it. My mom is still really she's famous for trying to sneak.
Yeah.
meat into my yeah. dishes, like you know, the Chinese dried scallops,
yeah,
they're quite easy to disguise yeah. so she would often like
slip. So confusing with you know, pickled radish,
it's yes
very similar,
so she'd slip that in a soup or mm-hmm. she'd make you know, like the jellyfish salad because she knows I really like salad, so she'd yeah. just go, but you love salad, and it's the only salad she makes
yeah.
so you know, she's like, in her view, that's not really meat. So
I mean, in some folks' view, jellyfish is not really meat.
Yeah, totally.
Your mom's doing her part to combat, you know, in some way, global warming and the oceans filling up with jellyfish.
That's right.
It's Chinese right. folks making jellyfish salad.
She's trying single-handedly.
But yeah, from my experience, I was a pescatarian, but I was mostly vegetarian for about 10 years
oh,
until
wow.
recently.
Oh, really?
And for the longest time, my family had a really hard time understanding what they meant.
Uh-huh, yeah.
And why I would do it and why I would choose to eat that way. And they would say, you know, this is just, you know, touching, or it doesn't taste that much like bacon.
Yes.
I feel like, I mean, obviously in Chinese culture, there are folks that are practicing Buddhists, and there is such an incredible legacy and culture of temple cuisine and vegetarian eating, specifically vegetarian Buddhist eating, but and vegan,
absolutely.
But for folks that have grown up with pork as a key food group,
yes,
it can be a little perplexing.
Well, I always say if I actually ate one meat, it wouldn't be fish, it would be pork.
Really?
Yeah, because I never liked fish that much. I actually wrote something about fish in the second issue too. Because fish, I was always told that I really didn't like fish. Mm-hmm. I still don't like the smell of fish now. Mm-hmm. But every Friday we would eat fish because my mum would go to the market and bring it home. We would each get our own fish.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember looking at it as a small child and just... it looked insurmountable, this fish that I was expected to eat. But she would tell me I could, it would teach me to swim. So if I ate the fish, I would be able to swim.
Okay.
So for years I ate the fish, but still not a great swimmer, Mum.
Well, something else that I really love about your writing and the work that you do is that it's all plant-based.
Mm-hmm.
Though I think there are people that are omnivores that come across your work, and it's not necessarily... obvious at first glance that it is that way, but it's so straightforward and simple, not and in like any kind of strategic way.
Yeah.
But I think it's super approachable and delicious and colorful, and people are like, oh, this is actually vegan or this is actually vegetarian.
Thank you. I mean, that's exactly the way my books have never been categorized as vegetarian.
Yeah.
That was my choice to start with, because even though I'm almost been a lifelong vegetarian, my food is... actually probably written more for omnivores, like people who enjoy all types of cuisine, because what I'm trying to show people is just like how to create, how to cook more creatively with vegetables.
Yeah.
Vegetables is probably my true, my true passion. It's probably why I do everything I do, is because I just, it just challenges me so much. It's hard to make, you know, some vegetables taste really, really tasty. And I think the feedback that I get from readers is, oh, my God, like I just made my husband, who hates broccoli, he just went and cooked broccoli on the barbecue, and it's changed our lives. So,
that's amazing.
Yeah.
I like these testimonials. Well, you said that this is something that you've sort of how you stuck by it and presented your work since you started publishing. Was there, what was the feedback like with editors and publishers? And did that ever, how has any of that conversation evolved, or conversation with your readers, especially now that people are seeking specifically plant, quote unquote, plant-based diets or plant-based recipes?
I have to say, even since the short time I've been doing this, which was, I started my salad business in 2011 in Sydney, in Australia, and it was kind of like, I just want to show people how to eat vegetables. So I made salads and put them in the box and cycled them around. And there were no salads. There were some salads, but they weren't, not like now. Mm-hmm. Like now everywhere, there's salads everywhere and like big vegetable-based, plant-forward salads. But there were certainly no real salad cookbooks back then. I mean, my two books are both exclusively about salads. Plant-based salads. And I think it's wonderful how in kind of 5 years that's changed. How if you go to a bookstore now, there is many, many books about plant-based eating and about salads, and salads every night, and salads for dinner and salads for lunch. I mean, I feel like the whole conversation has it's turned 360 degrees, which is amazing. And it's been amazing to see that change. But my first book has changed. I mean, the feedback I get is that it's changed the way people eat in Australia particularly. It's never been released actually anywhere other than Australia, my first book, Community. But that book's been on the bestseller list for something like 180 weeks.
That's amazing.
So it's almost 5 years old. So... it's pretty interesting to watch.
How, in the time since you published that book, are there recipes that you still go back to, or how, I guess, how have those recipes aged? or how have they sort of evolved in your mind?
They're incredibly... that book is like my fourth child because there is so much heart in every one of those recipes.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a self-taught cook, so in the early days of my business, I would probably spend an entire day working out what I would cook for the next week's salad deliveries, and that would just be four recipes.
Mm-hmm.
And I would be sitting there thinking about the vegetable that was in season and the grain or the legume it should go with, and then what mm-hmm. herb should I use to accentuate mm-hmm. the flavors. And so each and every one of those recipes has so much story, and I almost remember each one coming to life.
Mm-hmm.
And that was because I didn't really know that much. I wasn't a professional cook, so I was kind of learning on the job. But in that book, there are a lot of recipes that I have, kind of brought my Chinese heritage into.
Mm-hmm.
So my favorite, probably the salad, the recipe that embodies me is this, ginger scallion sauce with shredded vegetables and soba noodles.
Mm.
And it's probably the recipe that I make the most
mm-hmm.
Because it's all about the sauce. You can really put that sauce on anything.
Mm-hmm.
Like I've had events where I just have that sauce in my fridge and I just put it on roasted vegetables, and
mm-hmm.
time and time again people come back to me for that sauce. It's actually in the first issue of Peddler.
Oh, amazing. I think I ate a version of this with the soba noodles at when you opened
yes.
Neighborhood Studio.
I think you did.
Yours
yes.
and Jody's studio here.
Yeah. Yeah, it's such a winner that it's salty and a little bit spicy, and my mum used to make it, it's with the Hainanese chicken.
Mm-hmm.
So as kids, I remember myself and my siblings just fighting over the sauce. So
mm-hmm.
who cares about the chicken? We just mm-hmm. would eat that.
And it's just ginger, scallion and neutral oil?
Yes.
Or do you put other things in it?
Soy sauce.
Okay.
I put a little bit of vinegar in it, but the trick is heating the sauce. Oh. I mean, sorry, heating the oil.
Heating the oil.
Yeah. Because I've seen a lot of recipes that don't have the heated oil. I think the heated oil partially cooks the ginger and the scallions and just brings out the flavor.
Got it.
It's kind of dangerous, though. I've had people who've burnt down their kitchens doing it.
Oh, wow. I thought you were going to say, inflicted burns on themselves.
Yeah, no.
Burning a whole kitchen is something else.
I literally have, because they've not. They've poured the oil on too quickly. So just
wow.
be careful with that recipe.
On that note, I think we need to take a little break to keep the lights
good.
On in the studio. Recommended reading with Food Book Fair is on Heritage Radio Network, and an amazing community network for radio all about food, with many, many other shows, dozens of shows beyond this one. You can support Heritage Radio Network at heritageradionetwork.org, and you can also check us out, our archive, and the archive of many other wonderful shows here, and become a member today to support what we do. Thanks so much, and we'll see you, or we'll talk to you, in a few minutes.
The following program has been brought to you by Tabard Inn. Tabard Inn, Washington, D.C.'s quintessential small hotel, is located on a quiet, tree-lined street just 5 blocks from the White House. Vibrant yet unassuming, the Tabard is comprised of 40 sleeping rooms, each unique in character and design. Feast on eclectic American cuisine in their acclaimed restaurant, or enjoy a cocktail and listen to live jazz in one of their cozy Victorian seating areas. Mingle with travelers from around the world who find the Tabard the only place to stay when taking their travels to Washington. For more information, visit tabardinn.com. The following program has been brought to you by Route 11 Potato Chips. From the moment Route 11 Potato Chips dropped their first batch of chips back in the early days of 1992, they understood their destiny as a high-quality producer. Instead of succumbing to the frenzy of mass production, they took advantage of their small size and made chipping a personal art form. The payoff was immediate, an incredible potato chip. With a secret recipe and superior ingredients, their mission is to make an outstanding product in a safe and clean environment. In this world of uncertainty that we live in, Route 11 Potato Chips believes comfort food should be just that. Know where your food comes from. For more information, visit RT11.com.
Hey, Internet. This is Kimberly Chow with Recommended Reading with Food Book Fair on Heritage Radio Network, where we talk about what we're reading, watching, and listening to. I'm really happy to be joined in studio today with Hetty McKinnon. We are talking about her new food journal, Peddler, one of our favorite new foodie-oticals in our parlance, Food Plus Periodical. For those of you who don't know, now you know. We're also talking about what we're reading, watching, and listening to between ourselves, and we're kind of getting sidetracked in a wonderful way. But let's talk about what else Hetty has been reading. I see a huge new David Tanis tome.
Oh, yes. I had to bring this because I've just picked it up.
That's definitely subway travel worthy, even though it's so big.
It's like the type of book I want to crawl into bed with because it's so beautiful and the photography is so simple and beautiful. And he just, I mean, it's all about vegetables and what he calls market cooking, which is really, I'm so envious, it's how I want to live. Just going to the market and cooking what's there and what's in season. But it's really just so refreshing in its simplicity, and the writing is so beautiful. Like, he starts off with just writing about alliums, and it's just, you know, all about how they're meals in themselves. So if you have a scallion or a leek or an onion or a garlic, you can kind of make a meal out of that, and I love that idea. So it's really gorgeous. I mean, I've just got it just a few days ago. I went to Kitchen Arts and Letters and lugged this home from the Upper East.
Oh, man, I love making a pilgrimage there.
Oh, it's wonderful. So, yeah, I'm really excited to start cooking from this, but at the moment I'm just reading it.
I love a cookbook as bedtime reading.
Yeah.
Sometimes you can just look at the pictures.
Yeah.
He's a great, like, the head notes and all the chapter descriptions are so wonderful, though.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
With his stuff.
It's kind of like my, you know, right now I'm kind of attracted to books that are very clean and not over-styled and just kind of make the food. I feel like this, you know, there's a lot of oversaturated food images out there, which kind of, to be honest, it's one of the inspirations of why I wanted to create Peddler, because I wanted to create something that was very quiet, which probably goes against what the trends are in food right now. But it's funny because the people email me or message me and say, oh, the photography is dreamy, because I did want to create this kind of, I wanted people to feel really comforted by the images. The images are not screaming at you. I think this book has that, an element of that too. It's very calm.
Oh, I like that idea. What other, we don't need to talk about what's oversaturated, but what else would you say has that kind of quality that you're looking for that really pleases your eye now that you're seeing? You can talk about old favorites too. It doesn't have to be recent.
Oh, you mean books wise?
Yeah.
Oh,
books,
yeah.
Or other magazines or photographers who work you like.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think I was with Peddler, I was very influenced by Japanese magazines and the way that they are, like, they're not, it's something about Japanese magazines, they're not at all trendy. Like, they couldn't give us stuff about trends, and they just, it's like someone picked up their film camera and just shot someone having a cup of coffee. It's very minimal. It's very, you know, it's very grid-like almost. And so I went through a phase when I was researching the first issue of, spend a lot of time at Kinokuniya and invested in a lot of Japanese magazines. And that's been a really big influence on my aesthetic, I think, for the journal. But there's one cookbook that I always go back to, and it's Rose Bakery's Breakfast, Lunch and Tea.
That's so good.
It's probably my favorite cookbook of all time. And I've probably only ever cooked one thing from it.
I only have made one thing from it and kind of made it badly.
Yeah. Which one did you make?
Do you remember? The scones, but I had half the ingredients, so I subbed a lot of things, and they came out like rocks.
Yeah. I made the vegan loaf, which turned out pretty good.
Okay.
But I also subbed a lot of things. But that book, I always say it's probably my favorite cookbook of all time, because the photographer, I think, is Toby Glanville, who is not a food photographer. He's more a reportage photographer, and he is so inspiring. There is such humanity in those photos, and I don't even care what the recipes are. It's just the layout, the simplicity, the Polaroid three-quarter layout of the photos.
Oh, man, that book is so good.
Oh, I love it. I think I must pick it up at least once every 2 weeks.
This doesn't appeal to me, but I always like, I like the photo of... So there's a whole section about loaves, right? Or bakes.
Yes.
Bakes, tray bakes, yes, which I was like, what's a tray bake?
Before tray bakes were trendy, though. Yeah.
Now tray bakes are trendy. But there's the one where you can see the cross section of the broccoli, and I'm just like, I don't know if this would be good. But I was tempted
just
to make
about
it.
To say that. That is like such
the
an
iconic. The tray bake photo with the broccoli in it.
Yeah, it's such an iconic image.
It seems like something that would be, you know, like, you know, vegetables suspended in Jell-O, a very 1950s American thing. But it's so clearly English, or they're sort of kind of Parisian English.
Yes.
That I think
English photographers and English cookbooks have a very different sensibility, which really appeals to me. It's something about perhaps, you know, just the light there is very different. I feel like light makes it affects kind of the overall feel of things. Like with my book Neighborhood, it was shot in the, even though it was marketed as a summer book, it was like shot in the fall in New York. So it has a very fall quality to it. You know, it's a little bit kind of somber and moody at times. And I kind of always try to embrace that when we're working on a publication. So, but I think, you know, Breakfast, Lunch and Tea does it so well.
Breakfast, Lunch and Tea is really good. I love when people are excited about a book I'm excited about too. Or someone, you know, vice versa. And I know a lot of other people that are really devoted fans of that one, even if they don't cook out of it.
Yeah, it's funny.
It's just really nice.
I didn't
nice
realize
to look
there was such a subculture with this book.
Like a Rose Bakery obsession?
Yes.
Have you been to the one here?
I don't believe
in Dover Street
I have.
Market.
I've been to the one in London many years ago.
I've been to the one in Paris.
Yeah, I don't think I have been to the one here.
I kind of don't want to, like, ruin the magic.
Exactly.
It's like, I really love the dumpling joint, Ding Tai Fung, in Taipei, and there's like 40 of them all over the world. And I still think the original one, even though I have to wait the longest, is the best. Even though it's all the same recipe, roughly, and it's like a huge corporation now.
Yeah, totally. Is there one in New York?
There's no Ding Tai Fung in
New York. No, why is that?
I don't know. It would make sense that they would have one in Flushing or something like
that. Absolutely.
But in a lot of other... So Ding Tai Fung is, for listeners who may or may not know, it is the soup dumpling. Is soup dumpling the best all soup dumpling? Some people would argue that there are better soup dumplings to be found, but in terms of it's sort of like a it's the OG.
Yeah,
It's the one that perfected the form. Supposedly, there are 18 pleats on each individual dumpling.
And they weigh all their ingredients.
And they weigh everything.
Yeah, I remember when it first opened in Sydney.
And there's a big window, and you watch everyone work with their, like sterile chef's outfits. And often in other Chinese heavy cities, there will be a Ding Tai Fung. There's like two in Seattle. There's one in LA, I think. Not one in New York.
Really,
I used to have this fantasy that I would work on my Chinese and then I would become like a Ding Tai Fung franchisee in New York and I would bring it here.
Come on, I think you could
do
it.
That might be my, if it doesn't happen in the next, I don't know, 10 years, maybe that'll be my next career.
It's your calling in life.
Yeah. Cool. Sorry, I'm distracted by dumplings now, which is not a bad
easy
thing.
Easy to do.
Not a bad thing either. What else do you have in your, you brought a lot of books today.
Yes, I did. I just grabbed a bunch of things as I was... but the other magazine or foodiotical that I picked up also at Kitchen Arts and Letters is Eaten. Have you seen it yet?
No.
I haven't had a big chance to go through it. But it's a book about, it's a magazine, a food magazine. Sorry, I'm just reaching over. About
people
history.
Like to hear, I think people like to hear the rustle. Oh, yeah, because they rustling. Know it's like things are real in here.
Throw something across the room. but it's a food history magazine. And the first issue is The Food of the Gods. I don't know too much about this, where it's from. Is it American? I read one article this morning, which was about mantou, you know, which I actually spent all of yesterday making because there's a recipe in the second issue of Peddler. So I've been making this kind of vegetarian bun, like this with shiitakes and...
But is this just plain mantou or...
This is about the sort of the genesis of mantou and...
Non-Chinese people, it's steamed white bread.
Yeah. Well, you know, like... It's like bao, you know, that's now in the freezer aisle of Trader Joe's for some reason.
They have bao at Trader Joe's?
Yes.
Like the gua bao.
The white one.
Pac-Man one.
The Pac-Man. See, I never grew up eating that. I don't know if you did. It was never...
Gua bao, I thought, was only in, like, if you're...
It's filled.
Yeah, like a street stall or in a restaurant where it's filled.
Yes.
We always got the mantou, or you could get yinzijin, which was mantou where it has like the shredded stuff in the middle, which is just more mantou but in a different shape. It's like a bread sandwich, which is my favorite because I'd always pull it out.
Yeah, it's fun to dismantle.
The spaghetti squash of mantou.
Yes. So we had mantou too, and then char siu bao, obviously, in my meat-eating days. And, you know, ones filled with custard, which are probably... some of my faves.
We should have just done the show off-site, but have you been to this place called Fei Da Bakery? Oh. There's one on Center Street, and their custard, their Kaya custard buns. Yes,
I have been there.
My dear friend Charlene and I used to live together in Chinatown. She's Singaporean Chinese, and we lived a couple blocks away, and that was closest to the train, the 6th train on Canal Street. And we would... both go there all the time, and with another one of our good friends, Jenny, we still, if anybody goes to Fei Da, we text each other in the group text, happiness is a warm bun. It's like so cheesy, but, and actually now I find it too sweet for my taste because there's so much custard.
Yes.
It's so good.
Well, you know, I'm not a dessert person, but I have to say, like, that sweet bun is my undoing.
It's so good.
Yeah. But this
that's so bright yellow, though. I don't know. I don't know if the egg yolks are that yellow here.
It's funny. I kind of I like natural food, but when it comes to certain Chinese dishes that comfort me, I just really don't care. But this article actually traces mantou and its kind of origins across the world.
Okay,
so it's pretty interesting because it says it's very similar to Turkish manti, for example. Which
with the four pleats.
Yes.
So square
and
dumpling.
Then like Nepalese momos, which there's a recipe in the first issue of Peddler. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Korean mandu. And
so it puts it in the dumpling camp rather than the bun camp.
Which is controversial in my mind and could be in your mind too because...
And etymology. Is that the one about bugs? No, that's entomology.
Entomology.
Etymology is the one about words. Yeah. That makes sense to me, word-wise.
Yes. But for me, I feel like bao has, that word has become so popular that it's overtaken what a bao actually is, in my view.
In my mind, bao has something in it.
Yes, and it's more bready. Or like, you know, whereas a dumpling...
Yeah.
Is a dumpling with, you know, it's a thinner.
Yeah.
You understand what I'm saying.
Yeah. A bao is steamed white dough, usually white. I mean,
yeah,
I've
like
had
a bun.
Other
yeah. Yeah. Like a bun.
With something in it. And then dumpling is like a different kind of skin.
Yeah. We could go on about this.
Boiled or fried.
Boiled or fried. Or steamed.
We need to get in touch with Eden and ask them about this.
Yes.
But I love it. Food of the gods. How is mantou food of the gods?
Well, it's a pretty complicated story. I was reading it this morning. It was, it's you know, mantou, they say, translates to barbarian's head. So it was created.
Okay, sure.
So tou, I mean, is his head. Yeah. I don't know what the man is. Do you know what that is?
I don't know.
Mantle. Yeah, it's meant to like translate to barbarian's head. So they used to create this to cross a river because the river gods wanted a head, an actual head thrown across the river in order to allow people to cross. So they kind of made these to look like a barbarian's head. It's kind of morbid, isn't it?
Yeah.
But that's just one theory of where it came from.
Wow.
But it's full of pretty interesting things, Eton. And it's also aesthetically, it's laid out and it's kind of...
Ooh, I like that page.
Yeah,
we're looking cool, at a page with... Is it peanuts?
It's a honey cake.
I thought it was nuts on a plate.
Yeah, it's honey cake.
It's beautiful.
And there's also one about... I saw this, I haven't read it yet, but it's about food that's inspired by Jesus. Where is that?
I got to bookmark this.
Yeah. Oh, what did Jesus eat?
What did Jesus eat?
And then there's also, like, you know, food that's shaped, inspired by Jesus, like pretzels and the body of Christ. Look at that, hot cross buns.
As a person who did not grow up Christian, no. I am just as astounded Me too. by this.
Me too. So I'm looking forward to reading that.
Cool. I got to add that to my list.
Yeah.
Another reason to go up to Kitchen Arts and Letters.
Oh, yeah.
Did you get anything else on your trip there this time?
I did, actually. Well, I got this David Tennis and I got this crazy...
And the copy of Eden. That's already like 10 pounds combined.
Yeah, totally. And then I also bought... I bought this new cute little kids book about making kimchi.
Okay.
I can't remember what it's called, but it's everywhere at the moment. And they told me that it's a really hot seller.
Okay.
So it's like a picture book about a family making kimchi, and then at the end there's a recipe. So I bought it even though my kids are beyond picture books, but I just like the idea of it. And I bought this other, now I cannot remember what the Instagram handle is, but I think it's a Japanese girl, and she takes pictures of Audrey Hepburn and she superimposes vegetables on the top.
Okay.
It's absolutely riveting and it's hilarious. Amazing. And she had a periodical there. So they're stocking it. So
with the Audrey Hepburn pictures or is this one of the other things she does?
No, that's the actual periodical of her Instagram account. So it's turned into a magazine.
Wow.
Yeah. I wish I'd brought it now.
What's it called?
Can't remember, but what
if I'm just gonna Google Audrey Hepburn vegetable head.
Yeah, I can probably vegetable head. Yes. Anyway, I picked that up too, just because it's fun. It's funny because when I see magazines, I'm not so frivolous with money, but magazines is one of those things where I'm just like, I don't even care. I just have to have.
Here's the thing. After my birthday this past year, I started saying to myself, this is my philosophical gift to myself, that I would, you know, within reason, not worry about spending money on art or literature.
Yeah.
Like whether that was going out to a movie by myself or buying a paperback book or something like that. If that kind of work brings me joy. So I started justifying buying books, which I think is always something that can be justified, or magazines. And it's nice to, you know, buy something at the newsstand.
Absolutely. And I tried to, I mean, you know, Kitchen Arts and Letters is kind of a long way from where I live.
Yeah, so you got to stock up.
I was, yeah, and I was really happy to support a small bookstore.
Yeah.
You know, because I think we should, you know, it's an effort sometimes to go somewhere and buy something. So, you know, I think books and magazines and periodicals is a good way to spend your money. And, you know.
I agree.
Yeah.
That's why we're here. That's why we're here. So we're going to wrap up in a little bit, but I wanted to do a speed round inspired by you and David Tanis.
Oh, okay.
So.
I have had no warning of this, by the way.
I just thought of it just now. But I thought we would go over some favorite vegetables.
Oh, okay.
And we can talk about simple ways to cook them, mm-hmm. favorite recipes, or just things you think about when they come up.
Okay.
This is not as structured as a speed round as I've come across. And if you need help, you can flip through the David Tennis book, or we can look at Peddler.
Okay.
But I'm going to name about a dozen vegetables.
Oh, wow.
Or things that count as vegetables.
Oh, my gosh.
Just whatever's top of mind, whatever sounds delicious. What was the last thing you ate with them? And we're going to start with sesame.
Oh, I put sesame on everything. is this meant to be a dish?
No, it's just like word association or a dish or the last thing you ate.
Oh, like top every dish with sesame.
Toasted or raw?
I always have it toasted.
Okay, me too. Beets?
Oh, brined beets.
Ooh, yeah.
Recipe coming on the website for
okay,
that.
People look out for that one. What's the URL for this, for brined beets?
It's going to be on my website, so arthurstreetkitchen.com.
Tomato or tomato?
Oh, slow roasted. Posted a photo yesterday. Amazing. So much flavor. I cannot live through winter without a tomato. So.
Also on Instagram at Arthur Street Kitchen for that photo. Avocado.
Oh, I had it this morning in my miso porridge.
Ooh, that sounds good. Scallion.
Oh, also had it yesterday in my shiitake and baby bok choy buns.
Mm.
Always in my fridge, scallions.
Radicchio.
Ah, so radicchio is something I don't eat a lot of, but I love it kind of raw with like blue cheese, honey, walnuts.
That sounds good. Cabbage.
Oh, I love cabbage.
You can name a favorite kind of cabbage. You can name it.
I love Chinese cabbage, wombok or what do you call it? Napa cabbage. I love it.
Leeks. Going back to alliums.
Oh, I love leeks. Now, leeks I like to use as a base of a lot of things. But, I love it with mushrooms, like leeks and mushrooms. Something nice about that.
Mm. Sweet potato.
Oh, amazing. Roasted, whole, and I love it with olives because it's sweet. And then the salty of the olives it's mind-blowing. And I have a recipe in my first book.
What's the recipe?
It's a roasted sweet potato with a black olive and walnut relish.
Ooh. Are they the cured black olives or are they the
My favorite are they're the wrinkly ones.
Okay.
So they're the cured, right?
Yeah.
So they're really salty.
Those are so salty.
But that was one of the original salads that I made. And it's probably still a favorite.
That sounds delicious.
Oh,
and
so
how
good.
Can you tell our listeners how we can find you and find these recipes?
Well, you can
on the internet or in bookstores or the different handles at which we can locate you.
Like communities like Hot Property in the US because it's never been sold here. But I think I have a version of that recipe on my website. So if you go on and search sweet potato, I'm sure you'll find it. I have a lot of recipes on my website, www.arthurstreetkitchen.com, and in my book, Neighborhood.
And how do people find Peddler?
Peddler is available online at peddlerjournal.com. It's also available at Now Serving in LA, as you mentioned earlier. It's available at Booklarder in Seattle, and soon McNally Jackson's in New York.
Amazing.
Soon. Not yet, but soon.
Look out for that one. Well, so glad to have you on.
Thanks for having me.
We're going to geek out about breakfast, lunch, and tea after the show wraps because we've got no time left. But thanks for everyone who listened in. Lots of recommended reading listed. It doesn't sound like we've been watching or listening to anything, but that's okay. We're bookworms over here. Thank you, Hetty, for joining us. And we will talk to you next week, Internet. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Heritage_Radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. and we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Recommended reading is powered by Simplecast. Simplecast is a popular hosting and analytics platform that allows podcasters to easily host and publish to apps like Apple Podcasts. If you have a podcast or are looking to create your very first, check it out. Try it for free and save half off your first 3 months at simplecast.com/heritage.